Hello and welcome to another Understory, WA's only environmental radio show. I'm Tom Wilson. This week we hear from English comedian Ben Elton at a recent forum against the logging of forests in Western Australia. In the second half of the show, I talk with Danielle Witham from WWF about a recent survey of which regions most need to be protected in Southwest Australia. First, to Notre Dame in Fremantle, where Ben Elton recently introduced a forum on the logging of forests in Western Australia.
And I'm very pleased to hear that there's some people here from the logging industry, because this has got to be a community effort. Trying to think about how to create a sustainable Australia and a sustainable world can't be a matter of taking sides anymore. Things are so serious. The balance between jobs and communities and the future of the planet, and indeed the future of jobs and communities, because the planet is where all those jobs and communities live, is something that we all have to discuss together, which is why I think it's fantastic that the Forest Alliance have put the symposium together and welcomed everybody and anybody concerned with the issue to come and hear what we have to say, in the firm belief that the time has now come to put a stop to logging in WA, but also to discuss and consider what the alternatives might be, with a due consideration for the effect that that has on the communities who traditionally have been involved in that industry. But today we are talking about why we have to make a change. I've been interested in the environment for donkey's years. Sometimes journalists say, why are you so interested in the environment? I say, well, I live there. It's my address, you know. Been out in the environment, write to me. It's where, why are we all... It's so funny how sometimes people seem to think that, you know, greenies are interested in the environment, and then others just opt out as if it's not going to affect them. There's only one world. There's only one planet. No planet B, as has been memorably coined, that phrase. There is no planet B. We're all in it together. I first got interested in the environment actually after I listened to a speech by the Prince of Wales in 1985 about the North Sea, when he was talking then about the burden of scientific proof and asking whether the final proof has to be the complete death of the sea before anybody starts to do anything about it. I wrote my first novel, Stark, in Fremantle in 1988, just up the road in Marine Terrace. And that was very much a kind of fictional polemic based on environmental concerns. It's funny to think we hadn't even heard of global warming then. Of course, Tony Abbott still hasn't. But no, well, you might say that's a cheap shot. But, you know, I mean, this whole business about the science not yet being proved, you know, I mean... But I do understand why he's not too concerned about the water levels rising, because obviously as a lifelong member of the Flat Earth Society, he reckons it'll just all flow off the edge. But let's not get party political here. As I say, we're all in it together. I am terribly concerned. I have personal experience. I know personally my concerns for endangered species and disappearing environments. I recently tried to do a live comedy show on Channel 9. Honestly, I felt like a rare rainforest monkey. 3 weeks it went on. He's got 3 weeks to save himself, 2 weeks to save... He's gone. Paved over by another footy-based chat show. There you go.
Next, we heard from Brendan Mackey. He's from the Australian National University, and he was speaking on forests as banks of green carbon.
Most of the biomass carbon in a forest is in big old trees. So if you've got a logging cycle where you're going in and logging trees every 35 years, which is kind of what people are looking at now, sometimes it's a bit longer, after you've done that three or four times, you've basically got rid of all the big old trees and they're never going to return. So the standing stock of carbon is just a lot lower because most of the carbon is in big old trees. Also, the other pools of carbon get depleted. Okay, from intensive industrial-scale logging. The coarse woody debris pool gets depleted, depending upon the forest management practice. Again, it varies from type to type. There's often collateral damage to other living trees. There's actually increased fire risk. This has been shown in Central Highlands very clearly. You tend to disturb the soil, so there's soil carbon emissions. Irrespective of what the product is, not all the carbon that's in a tree ends up in a product. It's actually quite small. I've said 10 to 15% In terms of what ends up in a long-lived product, it might be 1% or 2%. I mean, we're talking very small numbers. There's a lot of wastage, if you like, from a production point of view. And, you know, people think they hear wood products, well, they must have a long time. Well, you know, most of our native forest logging goes to wood chip, which does not have a long time. If it's going to pulp and paper, it has a very short period of time, 1 or 3. If it goes to even if we look at saw logs, you know, most of the carbon in the saw log doesn't end up in a long-lived product. And of course, the most extreme of example of that, if we're just pulping, if you pulp old-growth forests and turn it into paper, it's really just a CO2 emission, because you know, the difference between how long the carbon would spend in the ecosystem versus how long it spends in a newspaper before it's put up into the atmosphere. We're only talking about a handful of years, case of newspaper. I think that there's a lot of strong scientifically based arguments for why we need to look at native forests different to plantation forests. I mean, I think we have cleared a lot of land, we have a lot of money invested in plantations, we have a very large plantation estate in Australia. I think there's enormous, 70% of the industry is plantation based already, and I don't think we're far away from having that 100%. And that's true globally as well. So I think that, you know, going forward, we need to think about how we can best make use of our different kinds of forests. What's the best use we can make of our native forests? What's the best use we can make of plantations? You know, and in my view, the best mix we can have is to let native forests do what they do best, which is stably store large, dense stocks of carbon for long periods of time, help regulate the local water cycle, provide habitat for wildlife, and keeping in mind that, you know, the natural biodiversity actually makes them quite resilient in the face of the pressures they're going to come.
Then Glenn Dewhurst from the Black Cockatoo Preservation Society spoke to us about some worrying developments for the cockatoos around Perth.
On the cockatoos that are coming in, when we first started, we get probably one a week. We're now looking at one a day on average, but we get reported of 2 deaths a day as well. This doesn't include the 150 to 200 we lost down at Hopetown 2 years ago. It doesn't include the 60 that was found on an orchardist property who'd shot over a few weeks. And also doesn't include another orchardist in around Lanston area who had 200 carcasses on his property. We're also finding that the cockatoos that are coming in a lot lighter. Okay, Carnaby cockatoos, around about between 620 to 650, Nassos, Redtails, and usually come in between 650 and up to 700, we're finding that each of the species have actually dropped weight by 150 to 200 grams of weight. That's a lot of weight. So for your mathematicians out there, you think about it from, if you weighed your 600 grams and you've gone down to 400 or 450, and that's a lot of money, that's a lot of body weight you're actually losing. Why is that? It's because they're not getting the food. The last 3 years, we have had a complete turnaround in the reason why the cockatoos are coming into our care. And it's because they're hungry. We do get them when they come in because they're hit by cars or they've been shot. We do get that. But we are finding most of our cockatoos are coming in now because they're hungry. And it's just sad.
Finally, as Ben Elton was leaving the building after the talk, I took the chance to ask him a quick question about his book from the late 1980s, Stark. In reading the novel, you might get the idea that there's some kind of evil consortium of business interests out to damage the environment. Heaven forbid, and that environmental activists are fundamentally ineffectual. So that's what I asked Ben.
I was just wondering if in the last 22 years since you wrote Stark, you think that environmental activism is still ineffectual? Environmental activists are ineffectual?
I didn't think they were ineffectual then, and I don't think they're ineffectual now. I think they're incredibly important and effectual, and the more people who are active, the more effective they'll be.
And would you equate the coal and the oil industries with the evil consortium?
No, I think that we're all part of the problem, we're all part of the solution. We all consume power, and we all have a footprint on this planet. It's time for the community as a whole to recognise that there's no planet B. We all live here, whether you mine coal, burn coal, or have no interest in coal, and we all need to work together. I think evil and good aren't the phrases we should use, but practical and impractical. And the truth of the matter that at every level, economically and morally, we need to start to protect the environment rather than consume more of it.
So yeah, I'm here at Panda Cottage, which is the WWF, World Wildlife Fund for Nature office in Herdsman's Lake in Perth. And it's a beautiful place to work. I'm here with Danielle Witham, and she is going to talk to me about the Southwest Australia Ecoregion Initiative that she's just finished off. Nice place to work, Danielle.
It's a stunning place to work. We're incredibly lucky.
Do you guys often find that you spend most of the day inside rather than out amongst the paperbarks and the swans?
Unfortunately, we're all a bit desk-bound here. But the any time there's a tiger snake, it certainly gets a lot of activity and action from people, and we run out when we see any snakes. So.
Yeah, I noticed there's some sign telling you to look before you step out the door for a tiger snake.
Yeah, that's for sure.
It's an exciting office. So. Getting on to the Southwest Australia Ecoregion Initiative, a bit of a mouthful, SWAI for short. What's SWAI?
Well, the Southwest Australian Ecoregion Initiative is a consortium which came together probably about 10 years ago of concerned conservationists. And they were really responding to what was happening in Western Australia, particularly in the Southwest Australia ecoregion, in relation to ad hoc planning decisions, and also what was happening with investment in relation to biodiversity conservation management actions as well.
Okay, so the SWAI project is a conservation planning project. Mm-hmm. What's your role been in this project?
Well, I've been program managing the conservation planning part of the project for the last 2.5 years. But really, with the Ecoregion Initiative, the consortium of people, they've really been doing a lot of work prior to us getting funding and being able to undertake the systematic conservation planning project and running workshops and trying to set, you know, what the vision for the ecoregion should be.
Okay, first of all, where is this ecoregion?
Well, the Southwest Australia ecoregion, it's a massive area. It's about 7,000 square kilometres, and it extends north of Geraldton. It's triangular in shape, so it passes down past Perth, past Bunbury, and extends to the South Australian border. So it's a massive area. And for those people who are aware, it includes the Southwest Australian Botanical Province and also what we call the Transitional Zone, which is where the Botanical Province starts to transition into the semi-arid areas before hitting the desert.
Okay, so that's where the region is. What's the problem in this area for conservation? Why did this project need to take place?
Well, I guess firstly, it's an amazing area. We should be incredibly proud of living in this particular place. It's one of the world's top 34 hotspots for biodiversity. It's recognised as an endemic plant area. WWF has also recognised it as one of their global 200 ecoregions.
Okay, that's all very well. A lot of people might not know what a biodiversity hotspot is. What do you have to qualify as a biodiversity hotspot?
Unfortunately, a biodiversity hotspot is sort of a bittersweet ranking. It's to do with the number of flora or plants that we have in the southwest of Australia. So we have, in the Southwest Botanical Province, over 7,000 different species of plants. Unfortunately, to get this ranking, they also have to be incredibly threatened. And that's the situation that we face in the Southwest Australian ecoregion. We have amazing diversity, particularly our plants, but also with some of our reptiles and frogs as well. But unfortunately, so much of what we've got is also incredibly threatened.
And why is it threatened?
A range of different reasons. Predominantly land use and changes that we've made to land uses historically as well as currently.
So basically knocking down the bush.
Yeah. And, you know, you may not be aware, but in the, I think it was in the 1960s, Western Australia actually had this million hectares a year policy where they were just clearing a million hectares in the Wheatbelt region. And anybody who's been out there in this day and age can see the devastating impact that that's actually had. this also results, this fragmentation and knocking down also results in secondary issues such as salinity. Unfortunately, we're also duplicating some of these behaviours and activities on incredibly important areas like the Swan Coastal Plain, which is also being cleared for urbanisation. And it's recognised that Perth is one of the most sprawled cities in the world per capita. So we've got a reputation for knocking it down, and it's just such an amazing place.
Okay, that's all very well. There's a lot of threatened plants and animals in southwest Australia, but hang on, I thought there was already a lot of conservation action going on with natural resource management groups and the Department of Environment and Conservation. And there's plenty of volunteers out there and people doing good things. Why do we need a conservation planning project?
You're right. There are amazing people doing a lot of amazing work. Unfortunately, what we see is, I guess with funding programs, they tend to be very short term. So we have this sort of ad hoc nature to on-ground management. You know, people get funded for 1 year, maybe 2 years. And they also get caught into that process or that cycle of meeting funding requirements, which might measure, you know, how many kilometres of fences you've put up or how many hectares of spraying you've done. It doesn't, or weed spraying, when I talk about spraying, it doesn't actually say, you know, what conservation have we actually achieved, what species have we actually protected. I think in relation to the Department of Environment and Conservation, you're right, and they do an amazing job, and they certainly have a lot of land vested in their estate that they are responsible for managing. I think as a society, we generally tend to think that all of the biodiversity can live in nature reserves or national parks, and it's just not the case, particularly in a region like this where we have what's called spatial turnover. You know, the vegetation is so amazing. You can stand in one spot and, you know, 5 kilometres, the vegetation complex is so completely different, you'll just get a completely different array of species in that area. So all of the biodiversity just can't live in these protected areas. So it's really important that we identify, we can use the protected areas or the conservation estate as building blocks, but then what we need to do is actually build upon them and pick up additional areas. So that could be private land, and working with, say, for example, farmers trying to manage land on their blocks or on their properties, but also looking at unallocated Crown land, as long as it's not being vested or its future land use isn't for urbanisation, of course.
I'm here at Panda Cottage talking with Danielle Witham about the Southwest Australia Ecoregion Initiative. But I suppose a large part of this is about prioritising areas to be conserved, isn't it? This is kind of a response to ad hoc actions that are happening right now. So a lot of stuff's happening right now, but maybe not happening with that grand scheme of these are the top priorities if we really care about conserving what's endangered. Is that a good grasp of the project?
I think that's a really excellent grasp of the project as well. And if we have a look at areas which have been selected historically for protection and for management, usually those decisions are also made in an ad hoc way as well.
Okay, and so we were actually sitting in the meeting room of the WWF office here in Perth, and on the wall is splashed a large image of the southwest of Australia with the areas for conservation action highlighted in dark green. Is that right?
Actually, the areas that we're most interested in are the lighter green areas. Those dark green areas are those lock-ins, those areas that are nature reserves, national parks, that we consider already protected and managed within the conservation estate.
So the lighter green areas. This map of the southwest has many splotches of, actually not that many splotches of dark green, which are national parks. We should have a few more probably, but a lot of it is lighter green, which is suggesting that those are the areas we should be focusing on if we're conservationists in WA in the southwest of Australia, as the results of this whole project and all this computer work would suggest. There's a lot of areas here. They're all over the southwest, not so many towards the transitional dry area in the north. and east, but otherwise there's a lot of them. How does this help us?
Actually, that's a really good point that you raise, and I guess if this is one of the... when people see these maps, a lot of people are quite surprised about how much land it's actually picked up. But for those of us who work in this field, actually aren't surprised because, as I mentioned before, this is an amazing place. Of course, it's going to pick up a lot of country. Because we have such a varied landscape and we have so many amazing things, of course the mapping is going to pick up lots of areas. And it really is just an indicator of how important so much of the southwest of Australia is.
Okay, so we've got this map here. It's quite extensive and it's the result of a lot of work by a lot of people. It's quite a valuable map that we're looking at right now here at Panda Cottage. Surely you have an ideal scenario for how this map would be used in the best of all possible worlds. What would that scenario be?
Well, I guess from a personal perspective, what I'd really love to see is ecoregion conservation happening from this. And that is where we get all of our stakeholders together and then determine the conservation targets for the conservation features or biodiversity features that we used in our analysis. We can work out how many of a particular species or a functional grouping of species actually needs to be retained and in which areas. And that then would inform the kind of management activities that different organisations do in different areas. That's a lot of work. It requires a lot of stakeholder engagement.
Wouldn't it be easier just to say, put all these areas into national parks, like 30% of Southwest Australia is a national park?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think that's going to be reality because we do have a lot of different land uses and people still do need to, live in this area and they still need to grow food and, it's about trying to find those compromises between them. Also we can lock up a lot of areas, but they also need to be managed and that requires resources. And I think that's probably one of the, when we have a look at the results of this mapping, one of the points that really comes out is how underfunded all of the organisations are that try to achieve conservation, and whether they be government agencies or local government, whether they be NGOs, the resources just need to be there, and there's a lot of work that needs to happen.
Okay, well, I hope this map is more widely viewed. Thanks very much for talking to Understory. That was Danielle Witham.